Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, a Chicago congressman has a new bill to ban the torture of prisoners by police. Citizens sue President Obama over preventive detention, and Nigeria's crisis of corruption is coming to a head. But first, about 400 demonstrators gathered in front of Harlem's Apollo Theater last week to protest a visit by President Barack Obama. Inside the Apollo, fans of the president paid $100 to $25,000 to hear him give a speech. Outside, activists like Ralph Pointer spoke to a very different crowd.
My check! My check!
My check!
I want you to know,
I want you to know,
that we all,
that we all
should have known better,
should have known better,
when Mr. Obama,
when Mr. Obama
said that he was for,
said that he was for
change,
change,
and
peace.
Peace. Amen.
I want you to know,
I want you to know,
that we should have known better,
that we should have known better,
when he started to run,
when he started to run,
and he went to the Black Caucus,
and he went to the Black Caucus,
to ask for their support.
To ask for their support.
When they asked him,
when they asked him,
why hadn't he,
why hadn't he
supported the issues of the Black Caucus?
Supported the issues of the Black Caucus.
His words were,
his words were,
he did not,
he did not
want to be tainted,
want to be tainted
by the civil rights movement,
by the civil rights movement.
We all know,
we all know
that Fannie Lou Hamer,
that Fannie Lou Hamer
only wanted to vote,
only wanted to vote.
This is what Mr. Obama,
this is what Mr. Obama
did not want to be tainted by,
did not want to be tainted by.
Therefore,
therefore,
when we choose not,
when we choose not
to support Mr. Obama,
to support Mr. Obama,
we want him to remember,
we want him to remember
all of his words,
all of his words,
where he did not want to be tainted,
where he did not want to be tainted
by the civil rights movement,
by the civil rights movement.
He said, stop whimpering, stop whining, stop yammering. So we want to say to Mr. Obama,
so we want to say to Mr. Obama,
when we don't show up to vote,
when we don't show up to vote,
stop whining.
Stop whining.
Stop whining, Mr. Obama.
Stop whining, Mr. Obama.
We no longer believe,
we no longer believe
that you will stand for anything.
That you will stand for anything.
You never stood,
you never stood
for the First Amendment.
For the First Amendment.
Right of free speech.
Right of free speech.
You never stood,
you never stood
for the Fifth Amendment.
For the Fifth Amendment.
Right to have an attorney.
Right to have an attorney.
You never stood,
you never stood
for anything,
for anything
that didn't support the corporation.
That didn't support the corporation.
We are standing,
we are standing
for all of the people,
for all of the people,
not the corporation.
Not the corporation.
Mr. Obama,
Mr. Obama,
we are going to,
we are going to
send you back home,
send you back home
to Chicago,
to Chicago,
where you helped destroy,
where you helped destroy
the projects,
the projects.
We need,
we need
someone who stands,
someone who stands
for housing,
for housing.
We need,
we need
someone who stands for jobs,
someone who stands for jobs.
We need,
we need
someone,
someone
who will be true,
who will be true
to the words they say,
to the words
Ralph Pointer on the mic check outside the Apollo Theater in Harlem. The demonstration was pulled together by our own Nellie Bailey. She was interviewed by Don DeBar of WBAIX Radio.
This rally was called by Occupy Harlem, along with a number of other sponsors and endorsers, and we're here to send a clear message to President Obama that he will not come to Harlem and not receive a scathing message of his service to the 1%.
We just had the Dr. King holiday pass. I was listening to some of the things that were being played on the radio, and one included the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my country. That was when there was one war going on in Vietnam.
And now we have three wars going on. Not only that, we have a military budget greater than all of the military budgets of the nation states in the world combined. That is where we are. And we have seen the expansion of war under Obama than under President Bush. We have the National Defense Authorization Act under Obama, not under Republican Bush. We have NDAA that can be used by any sitting president, including right-wing Republicans.
And what is the NDAA for people that aren't familiar with that?
It is the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that authorizes the indefinite detention, arrest without judicial review, charges of any American citizen on American soil at the behest of the president. Only the President of the United States can authorize this. And we say that this is dangerous, despite the fact that President Obama says that he would not authorize the use of NDAA, but he has proven in so many instances of that he does not tell the truth, and we know that he can and will authorize the use of this bill. And we believe that this bill and the passage, particularly at the beginning of an election year, is to outflank the Republicans in terms of his right of center agenda, and secondly, to have a law that will crush any militant dissent and protest here in this country as the U.S. plutocracy and oligarchy expand their illegal wars, occupation, and military aggression against nation states.
Back in 2008, for the national conventions of both the Democratic and Republican Party, there were arrests that were made of activists and organizers before the convention started, and essentially preventative detention by overcharging them and holding them in prison until the thing were over. And some faced felonies even after that. At the time, President Obama was made the nominee of the Democratic Party in Denver. This was happening. And now they have, going into this year, we have all the occupations going on around the country that are under assault by police all over. What do you see happening with the NDAA in that climate?
Oh, I think without a doubt, it's the rise of a police state. And the repression abroad is now in full force and enforcement here in this country. I think we have no idea, people in this country have no idea what is in store for them. And at a time of an economic depression that, in fact, will push even more people out in the street because of the conditions on the ground. And I believe that the intent of this of NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, is to deliberately send a chilling message and a warning that if you challenge us, this is what will happen to you.
Nellie Bailey of Occupy Harlem and Black Agenda signed a report at a protest against Barack Obama. As we said earlier, about 400 people from various organizations attended the demonstration. However, Democracy Now! And others erroneously reported significantly smaller numbers. We can only conclude that their pro-Obama prejudices prevailed over their journalistic responsibilities. Among the crowd was a large delegation from Stop, Stop and Frisk. The group was organized to fight police abuse of power, but is also opposed to the new preventive detention law. We asked activist Jose LaSalle if he ever imagined, when Obama was elected in 2008, that he would sign a bill to imprison American citizens without charge or trial.
No, I never thought anything like that was going to happen. When I see him being elected, I was very proud of that. You know, say for the first time there was a change up there in the system. You know what I'm saying? There was somebody that I could relate to, you know, in the office, and I never thought that he would, you know, sell out like this to the point where he would sign a bill like that and know that it affects the minority race and the people that is out here protesting and fighting for justice and fighting, you know, saying to keep their constitutional right as a human being here in this, you know, say in this planet.
I haven't heard President Obama say anything about stop and frisk in New York City or in Philadelphia, where it's twice as bad. Have you?
No, I haven't heard him speak anything about anything of that nature. He's been avoiding those things. I mean, I've seen people pose questions to him about this situation, stop and frisk, and about the Occupy Wall Street and what's taking place over here and all over the world with all this protesting and uprising against, you know, saying the injustice that's taking place. And he deviates from all these questions. I'm the 99%, and this is just the beginning. We ain't going to stop until, you know what I'm saying, we make a change.
That was Jose LaSalle at the anti-Obama demonstration in Harlem. The New York City Police Department's voracious appetite for African-American male bodies has caused huge disruptions in black family life. Mary Black is the mother of a teenage son who was stopped 5 times by police in the space of 5 months, all within 2 blocks of the family's apartment in Harlem. Ms. Black has joined up with Stop, Stop and Frisk. She told a press conference why.
One particular day, I was home. I had just came home from school. And he had just left out the house. He was gone no longer than about 5 minutes. Unfortunately, my bell rang. And it was a neighbor telling me that the cops had my son up against the wall. Now, he was on his way to the gym at that moment. So I run downstairs at that moment. I didn't have any clothes on. I had to go downstairs with just my robe and my socks, and it was a cold day. And I seen him handcuffed in the back of the police car. I don't know. I know a lot of y'all probably can't relate to it, but as a mother,
I can.
When you see your child being treated as a criminal, when you know that you teach him moral values and standards and ways to carry on to lead a productive life. But at that moment, all of that went out the door. Because when I approached the officer and I asked him, what did my son do or could I see him? I was told no. I would have to go to the precinct. So when I did get to the precinct, I asked them, what did he do? Why was he arrested? Why was he in handcuffs? The response to me was, he talked too much. So now, as a mother, I had to beg. And I asked him to please just think of what I'm doing. Because I'm trying to raise him to be a good kid. Go to school, get your education, and do what you need to do in life. So at that moment, I broke down. And I told him, he's a good kid. Just give me a chance. Don't arrest him. So, you know, he agreed to just give him a discipline and not send him to Central Booking. But what I'm saying is that moment should have never occurred. And I, being a mother, have to stand out and say, you have to look at me because I am someone. My child is someone. He is not a criminal. So the policy that you have, or whatever policy they have, it has to be looked at and asked, you know, do people like myself and many others of y'all that's standing around deserve for our children to be treated this way. And that's why I'm here this morning, to let the world know that if anyone is experiences like I'm experiencing, the way we're going to get our voice heard is by speaking up.
That's right.
And if we don't speak up, they're going to look at it. This is what we can do. Because nobody's going to say anything. I'm a working mom. His father's a working father. When you see your child in a police car, that's your child. You know that's your child. But once them handcuffs go on, you have no say-so over your child. And that was a hurting moment for me because it was nothing that I could do. You know, I just want a lot of us to come out to speak up and to do something about this. The reason that I'm so adamant about it now is because in a 5-month period, my son had 4 summonses and 1 arrest. And that's one of the reasons why I'm adamant about doing something about this. Because when you look at it, 5 months, 4 summonses and 1 arrest, something is wrong with that picture. And I'm a mother that keeps very close tab on that child. He doesn't run from here, there, all over the place. I'm talking about this was done in a 2-block radius from home. That far as he can get out of my sight is, I live on 137, or as far as he can go is 135. That's it. Now you ask yourself, what's wrong with that? And when he got arrested right across the street from where I live. He was up against the wall right across the street from where I live. Just left out the house 5 minutes.
Mary Black, a Harlem mother who fears that lawless cops will take away her son for no good reason. Veteran journalist Chris Hedges fears that anyone can be thrown into prison without trial under the preventive detention bill signed into law by President Obama. So Hedges has sued the president. We asked Hedges how he decided to take on the White House.
It actually wasn't my idea. Carl Mayer, who has been involved in lawsuits to defend the assaults against civil liberties, including the ACLU lawsuit against the FISA Reform Act, of which I am one of the plaintiffs, came to me and said, look, under this legislation, someone like you could be potentially, because of the nebulous language, charged. You've had direct personal contact with groups that the state has defined as terrorist organizations. There are no provisions in this legislation to exempt journalists. Would you be willing to be a plaintiff? And I said yes.
Particularly ominous in this legislation is the use of the term substantial support, not material support. And most
right.
people think they understand what material support is, giving
right.
money, passing a gun, something, right. but substantial support.
Right, and it can be substantial support for something called associated forces. So it leaves open such a broad interpretation that there is no protection for someone like me under this law, or I think for ultimately any kind of dissident, because there's been a clear effort on the part of the security state to try and tar the Occupy movement as a movement that is an enemy of American democracy. When you look at the list or the criteria by which the Attorney General's office can investigate people for terrorism, tossing in a couple obstructionist tactics by the Occupy movement isn't much of a stretch. I mean, people who are missing fingers on one hand, people who store over 7 days worth of food and provisions, people who have weatherproof ammunition. I mean, they're going to have to round up my entire family in rural parts of Maine.
That's their profile of the potential terrorist.
Yeah, as worthy of investigation. We know that there are, at this point, probably tens of millions of Americans whose, because of the FISA Reform Act, whose emails, phone messages, all of which are being monitored by the government.
In terms of substantial support, that could be interpreted as speech, giving aid and comfort to someone that they declare is the enemy.
Yeah. The way the law is written is, you know, when you read it really closely, is really terrifying because it's the whim of the security and surveillance state. Whoever they want to go after, they can pretty much do so under this piece of legislation. And then, of course, the way they do it is to use the military to carry out extraordinary rendition on American city streets. and deny American citizens due process. And I think that, you know, to listen to the Obama White House, you know, Obama assured in his signing statement that he would not use this legislation to target American citizens. Well, Dianne Feinstein proposed inserting into this legislation a clear statement that American citizens would be exempted from it. And this was rejected by both the Democratic Party and the Obama White House. They had an opportunity to do it, and they didn't. And we know from leaks out of Carl Levin's office that the difficulty that the Obama White House had with the bill was not over the denial of due process, but the fact that the executive branch wanted to abrogate for itself the right to decide who, what American citizens would be subject to arrest and detention without access to a lawyer or courts by the military, and who would be given exemptions. It was a debate about the prerogatives of the executive branch. It was never a debate about due process or the rule of law.
Now, if we don't have due process, do we have the rule of law?
Well, if you don't have due process, you don't have the rule of law.
Are you optimistic?
I don't have a lot of faith in the Supreme Court. We saw the case of Jose Padilla. They used to call him the sort of missing hijacker. He was a U.S. citizen held for 3.5 years in a military brig without access to a lawyer or due process. Was challenged, went up to the Supreme Court, and before the Supreme Court took up the case, he was transferred to a civilian court. And the Supreme Court said they wouldn't rule on it because it was moot. I mean, they sort of passed it. But given the composition of this particular Supreme Court, I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but I still say we have to try.
Apologists for Obama say, well, this law is nothing new. President Bush claimed the right to detain anyone based on his own criteria and without charges, and that this is nothing new. But it is something new when you codify it into law with the benediction of the Congress.
They're right only in this sense. Under the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act, they already were doing a lot of this stuff, including, of course, targeting American citizens for assassination. Barack Obama serving as judge, jury, and executioner for Anwar al-Awlaki, the cleric who was murdered in Yemen. But I think that for most legal scholars saw that as a fairly radical interpretation of that piece of legislation. Just essentially legalizes, overturns 200 years over 200 years of law to permit the armed forces or the military to carry out domestic policing. And I think the other important thing about this piece of legislation is that the 2001 Act was tied to groups that were directly related to Al-Qaeda. This now permits this kind of war against a multiplicity of groups, many of which didn't even exist when 9/11 happened. Groups in Yemen, groups in Somalia. It's a way of sort of cementing into place the permanent war psychosis. And remember that these people can be picked up by the military, held without charges, without trial, without access to an attorney, in the language of the bill, until the end of hostilities. Well, you know, when is that? This is an endless war. The 2001 Act was bad enough. But, you know, at this point, to pass a piece of legislation like this, which goes into effect in March, is catastrophic assault against what's left of civil liberties and our anemic democracy.
If this bill had moved through Congress when Bush was president, would you have expected a hailstorm of protests?
The Democratic Party is very good at expressing moral outrage against George Bush or Republicans, but doing absolutely nothing to counter those activities. So, yeah, you would have had the Democratic Party and the liberal establishment speaking out against it and expressing deep disgust and distaste for these measures. And yet, at the same time, I think, you know, what these people do and what they say are very different.
That was journalist and author Chris Hedges. For decades, police in Chicago routinely used torture to force suspects into confessions. Detective John Burge was the most notorious. Between 1972 and 1991, Burge and his men tortured at least 200 people, almost all of them black men. Burge himself went to prison in January of last year. Black Chicago Congressman Danny Davis has introduced legislation targeting targeting police torture of prisoners. Davis held a briefing for the bill on Capitol Hill last week. Among those who testified was Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Taylor said police torture of prisoners has been widely known since the days of Chicago's legendary boss, Mayor Richard Daley.
He didn't prosecute. The U.S. attorney at that time didn't prosecute. No matter how loudly we and the community registered its outrage, there were no prosecutions. So many, many years later, there was an honest U.S. attorney who decided to investigate this and decided that he would use perjury and obstruction of justice because these men in lawsuits we brought lied about whether they tortured people. So he took those lies under oath and prosecuted Burge for obstruction of justice. Burge is now in the penitentiary for 4.5 years, which was the most that he could be sentenced for all these horrendous crimes. So Congressman Davis and we and members of the community said, this is not right. It's time to recognize torture in federal law for the crime against humanity that it is. Like genocide and slavery, torture is outlawed under the International Conventions Against Torture, and it in fact is treated as a crime internationally without a statute of limitations. If there were no statute of limitations in federal law at this point, Burge and his men could have been and could be prosecuted for the crimes that they committed and could be sentenced for the serious nature of those crimes. Unfortunately, that did not and cannot happen. So this bill reintroduced in this Congress, and as Congressman Davis said, as an agent of change, it may not get passed and be passed at this session, but it will keep coming back, and it will still be on the conscience of the collective Congress until it is passed. And it does two very important things. Not only does it define torture and make torture a crime in this country when law enforcement officers commit it, but it also does away with a statute of limitations. So for those reasons alone, this bill is very important. But it is also extremely important not only in what it does, but in symbolically in what it says. Because torture in this country cannot be countenanced. It cannot be on the conscience of this country. Torture cannot be. And so until we totally eradicate torture, make it a federal crime, make it a prosecutable crime, the conscience of this country, the conscience of the city of Chicago, and certainly the conscience of the body of the Congress will not be cleansed. You know, the code of silence is such an important aspect of this case. Even though it was well known that the torture was going on for many years in the station houses and in the state's attorney's office and in the high levels of the police department, no one would come forward. The way that we found out that this was more than an isolated incident of one extreme torture case was through anonymous letters that I received from a police officer who worked with Burge, who was so terrified by the idea that he would be identified for coming forward against the torturers that he sent these letters anonymously. But what he did was let us know that there were other victims of torture and let us know who the names of the other torturers were. And based on that, we were able to unpeel the onion over the last 20 years that led to naming and documenting over 110 cases of police torture, all African-American men save one African-American woman. So the code of silence has been extremely powerful in these cases, and it's one of the other reasons why the fact of no statute of limitations is so important, because cover-up in the law enforcement and in the military is so powerful because the police have the gun and they have the ability not only to ostracize you but to put a bullet in your back if you're enforcing the law, that in fact the statute oftentimes is necessary because they'll be able to cover up the torture for many years and officers won't come forward until they retire, if they come forward at all.
Attorney Flint Taylor speaking on Capitol Hill in Washington. Daryl Cannon was one of the victims of Chicago's police torture squads. He spent 2.5 decades in prison after Detective John Burge's men tortured a false confession out of him.
I am deeply moved by something that Dr. King continues to say, even in death, and that is dealing with the mountain of despair. Here again, this bill tends to do just that. It tends to hurt. It tends to make explicitly clear that torture has existed here in the United States for quite a while. Chicago is notorious for having had gone through a period of time from the Democratic Convention all the way through today's events in dealing with police torture. But people like Daryl Cannon refuse to be silent, refuse to give up, refuse to believe that justice will not prevail. This bill would not change the hatred or anything else that people like me have been through. If you ask me, am I still bitter about having been tortured, I would tell you without hesitation, yes, I am. If you ask me, how do I feel about those that tortured me, I would tell you that I hate the air that John Byrne breathed. I hate the air that Peter Dignit breathed. Again, I'm hopeful that Congressman Davis will, in fact, pressure or do whatever is necessary to see to it that Peter Dignit is brought to justice the same way that his mentor, John Burns, was brought to justice. Likewise, for the other Burns that committed torture along with them, because justice delayed is justice denied, so said Dr. King, and reality is reality. Please understand that on the morning of November the 2nd, 1983, I experienced torture at its greatest heights, such that I couldn't imagine before then. I mean, to have 3 white detectives take you to an isolated area and throughout the day call you nigger. Your name was never Daryl Cannon. Your name was nigger, nigger this, nigger that. And to have a detective take a shotgun shell and have you in an isolated area with your hands cuffed behind your back, and he tell you, he said the words of nigger, listen. And he showed me a shotgun shell, and then he turned his back to me. I heard what I thought was the shotgun shell being placed in a chamber. And when he turned back around, I don't see the shotgun shell. And he asked me then, nigger, you gonna tell us everything you wanna know? And at that point, I told him I didn't have anything to tell them about anything. His other 2 detectives, John Burns and Grunhardt, told him to go ahead, blow that nigger's head off. And they attempted to force shotgun barrel in my mouth. I didn't voluntarily open my mouth, and as a result from that, they split my upper lip and chipped my 2 teeth in the shotgun barrel in my mouth. And once they got the shotgun barrel in my mouth, they asked me the questions again. Was I going to tell them what I knew about a crime? And I told them no. And at that point, Peter Dignit pulled the trigger on the shotgun. Then he took the shotgun barrel out of my mouth. He went in his pocket and pulled the shell back out and told me, nigga, listen. They repeated that 3 separate times. And on the 3rd time that I heard the click from the shotgun, to show you how the mind is, in my mind, I honestly thought they blew the back of my head off. But they didn't stop there. They tried to hang me by my handcuffs that was cuffed behind my back. They wasn't successful in that because of the fact that it was raining that morning out there, and the detective couldn't keep his footing on the back seat, on the back bumper of the detective car. They then redid my handcuffs that was in front of me, and they made me lay down in the back seat of a detective car. They pulled my pants and my shorts down, and the detective took out a cattle prod and turned it on and proceeded to shock me, electric shock me on my testicles and my genitals with this electric caliper. The pain was so excruciating that I tried to kick the caliper out of one of the detective's hands, and I was successful in doing so. And in doing so, the back of the caliper popped open and the batteries came out. They put the batteries back in and proceeded to do this again, again, and again. They shocked me. It seemed like it was forever that they shocked me with this electric caliper. And in the process of doing so, they told me what they knew about the crime. And I agreed to tell them that my mother did it, if that's what they wanted me to do. Anything to stop the electric shocks, even though my mother's never committed a crime. But this is how barbaric they were. And it wasn't a job that they was doing. You know, you can look at someone and tell when they don't really want to do what they're doing. But these three detectives loved what they was doing. They had the look of joy on their faces all while they tortured me up under the color of law. And that's the thing that I can't get away from, the fact that this was did under the color of law. And they were able to go into court and raise their right hand and swear to tell the truth, and did so and said that they had never did anything wrong to me whatsoever. Yet and still, after two new trials, no evidence presented against me, no witnesses, no nothing except the alleged torture confession. Finally, the state's attorney's office decided to drop all charges against me and to release me after doing 24 years. My last 9 years of those 24 years were did in Supermax Penitentiary, where you had no contact with anyone. So the system continued to try and torture me the very best that they could. But I'm thankful to God that the spirit of my mother and my grandmother reside within me and made me stubborn enough not to give up and to persevere regardless of what. And I'm here today to say that this bill needs to be passed. It needs to be passed to protect those of the future. It can't protect people like me, Anthony Holmes, and others, because what was done to us was dear to us. Dr. King once said that out of everywhere he's ever been in the South, he didn't experience racism as worse as he did until he came to Chicago. I didn't understand it then when he first made that statement, but after November the 2nd, 1983, I clearly understood what he meant by that, because unlike the South or anywhere else, Chicago was the most racist city in the city of Chicago, in the country for that matter, especially when it came down to torture. When I first alleged about torture, no one wanted to believe that three detectives would stoop so low to be so barbaric, you know. But now it's no longer a shock. Now it is the truth. People like Danny Davis has taken the courage to stand up and to speak on it when in the past it hasn't been politically correct to do so. I'm thankful to him. I'm thankful to my lawyers. I'm thankful to all the committees that continue to fight this battle dealing with police brutality. And I hope and pray that today we will learn some viable lessons again from the past, and we will not be doomed to the future. This bill is crucial in being passed. There should be no delay. Torture exists in Philadelphia. Torture exists in New York. Torture exists in Rampart, California. You know, so it's not just Chicago, but Chicago is taking the lead role in trying to set in place laws that will stop this and laws that will say that ain't no such thing as a statute of limitation on torturing a person. They can't bring me back to the 24 years that I did. While I was in prison, I lost my mother, my father, my son. I lost a lot of loved ones that I cannot get back. So I'm saying to this committee today, please do not play games. Do not delay. do what is necessary to pass this bill, to see to it that a measure of justice is in fact rendered in this situation. Please, and please know that, don't feel sorry for Daryl Cannon, you know, because the tears I shed is pure hatred. I kid you not, pure hatred. And I know my lawyers don't like me to speak like that, but, you know, I have to tell you the truth. You know, I can't tell you that I can forgive and forget. I can never forgive. I can never forget. You know, only God can do that. Only thing I can do is tell you how I feel. And I hope and pray that something will be did soon about this, because there's a lot of Daryl Cannons who have been victimized beyond a shadow of a doubt. And at some point in time, justice needs to prevail. Dr. King went a long time before he got a measure of justice. He gave his life in order for us to be where we are today. So Daryl Cannon is saying, and those on behalf of Daryl Cannon who have experienced this and who have not been able to speak, I speak for them in saying that torture is never right. I don't care what the occasion is, torture is never right. Let justice prevail, and I thank you for your attention, and I'm sorry that I got kind of emotional like I do, but this is a subject that affects me personally in more ways than one. So because of that, you see what you see. It's simple as that. Hopefully all of you will push. And Congressman Davis, I'm so thankful that you got the backbone that you have in leading this fight here. And my attorney, Flint Taylor, People's Law Office, and other committees, we would never be at this junction if it hadn't been for you and all the hard work you continue to do, the threats that you have had to endure. So please, committee, know that this is a human problem. This is a problem that the same way you deal with other countries and wanting to help them, then let's help us. Let's help us at home. Let's be the lead and say that, hey, look, we're taking steps right now to clean our house and to do what is necessary to ensure that no more torture. Thank you.
Daryl Cannon, a victim of torture at the hands of Chicago police. The Nigerian military patrols the streets of Lagos and other cities in Africa's most populous country. A general strike opposing the government's increase in gasoline prices ended, but many grievances remain. We spoke with Aniyedi Okure of the Africa Faith and Justice Network in Washington.
There are a number of things that generated the strike. Although it was the price hike in petrol, in gas, as we call it here, even though it was said that it's price subsidy removal, there is more to it than that, which I'll come back to that in a minute. That's the last straw that broke the camel's back. But there are other issues. There's the issue of overpaid politicians in a situation where you have even a senator making more annual salary than President Barack Obama. Yet there is the issue of decaying infrastructure, and the money is there that should have been invested in the infrastructures, but leadership is embezzling the money. There is the issue of safety with the Boko Haram terrorizing the people in the northern part of the country, terrorizing Christians, and there is a real feeling of not being safe. And there is this general idea of, you know, the lack of the rule of law, that leadership seem to act with impunity. They make the rules for others, but nothing is touching them. And so when you threw all that into the mix, coupled with the presence of a highly educated and unemployed young people, so you have a very disgruntled population, disaffected, who feel alienated from the structures of governance. So even though the strike has been called off because the president reduced the price hike from 141 naira to now 97. That still hasn't cut it. The basic fundamental issue is that how did the country get to this, to be in a position where it has to, quote, take money from the poor to invest on infrastructures, which we know that same amount of money could be obtained elsewhere, precisely by cutting down on the excesses of politicians and monitoring and really taking care of how the oil revenue is appropriated.
The people of the Delta, where most of the oil comes from, have had a grievance for a very long time that the oil never helped them at all. Is there a possibility of some form of greater unity in Nigeria behind these common grievances?
Actually, there has been. In fact, the strike was responded to in the north and south, east and west, midwest, everywhere. There is a big distraction here, unfortunately, which is the Islamic fundamentalism that seems to distract from what is going on, because this is not a matter of affecting the north or the south, east or west. It's affecting every part of the country. The unemployment, the grievances that have been talked about affects every part of the country. However, people in the south feel more affected by it because, especially in the southeast, where the oil is taken, the roads, the federal roads, are just a disgrace. They're worse today than they were 20 years ago. The infrastructure decaying, and yet you have these politicians taking out billions and pocketing them in foreign accounts. So that's one issue. There's also in the Niger Delta region, where you've referred to, and in parts of the south-southeast, where there has been repeated oil spills and damaging the environment, not just from an ecological point of view, saying, oh, protect the environment, but because it has really annihilated the livelihood of people. People who were fishermen, who made life through fishing. The waters have been polluted. They can't fish the way they used to. The land with oil spills. So those things have really directly affected the livelihoods of people around the region. And so when you refer to the Niger Delta grievances, it's not just a bunch of touts trying to terrorize people. They have been pushed to the wall to the extent that they see the lives that their parents or grandparents had evaporating before them, and they can't do anything about it. So they take to arms. I'm not in any way suggesting that that is the right course of action. But when you push people to the wall and they feel powerless, they can resort to all kinds of tactics. So, and that's the case here.
If the Nigerian government is corrupt, and it is universally agreed it is, then it is corrupt in conjunction with the oil companies.
Absolutely. In fact, I really think that the oil has been more a curse to Nigeria than a blessing. The reason being that the discovery of oil has led to the abandoning of other segments of income-generating enterprise within the country, farming especially. Nigeria used to export food, cocoa, palm oil and kernel, wheat, sorghum, name it. But when the oil came and the central government got a hold of it, it kind of just concentrated money at the center of government. And so everybody wanted a pie of that. And gradually, we see the erosion or the migration of young, talented people to the urban areas to get a piece of the cake. And we abandoned the agricultural industry really, really bad, to the extent that now Nigeria is spending tons of money, millions, importing food. A country that used to export food now imports food, including rice. You know, used to produce a lot of rice, now it's importing all kinds of stuff. And the government there does nothing about it.
Well, oil could certainly not be a blessing to the average Nigerian who makes $2 a day, which doesn't buy a gallon of gas.
No, it doesn't. In fact, what has happened now is that there are four major refineries in the country. Three of them are not working. And the one that is working is only at 10% capacity. And why is that? Because those at the helm of affairs find it profitable when they send the oil out to be refined here in the U.S. and brought back. They are readily able to get the finished product and appropriate it to themselves. So there is somehow in many ways an undermining of the structures of government, of what should have benefited the country. People undermine it because it benefits their pocket, their families. Again, too, Nigeria used to generate enough electricity to sell to our neighboring countries, Niger and Chad, for example. And now you can't do anything. You can't predict electricity. Sometimes it's out for a week. And so people are buying generators to keep things going. You see the way things are going, you cannot but conclude that people who are in the importing industry, importing generators, are actively engaged in undermining the distribution of power or having electricity function, because that will cut into their business. So it wasn't just that petrol was for driving cars. No. Petrol is the livelihood of many Nigerians. You need the petrol to put into the small generator, to generate electricity, to be able to charge your cell phone battery, because landline is virtually non-existent. You need the petrol to put in the generator to be able to turn on your TV. You need to, you know, for all kinds of things, you need petrol to do that. And so, hiking the price of petrol means a lot more than driving car. In fact, driving car is only about 10% of it, or 20% if we want to just be generous. Because the livelihood of Nigerians, small businesses, people who have small grocery stores and need refrigerator, they have to keep the, you know, the generator running throughout the day to keep things in the refrigerator cool and cool. So when out of a sudden the president woke up and announced this, it blew me off, really. It is the reason why Nigerians were so united and were ready to go any length, because they've had enough. They've had enough.
Nigeria suffers from vast wealth disparities. I'm told that Lagos is more expensive to live in than European cities.
Honestly, you see, Nigeria was doing pretty well. In fact, in the 70s and into the 80s, we had a burgeoning middle class. And then out of a sudden, at the advice of IMF, International Monetary Fund, the government decided to, quote, go on structural adjustment program, because they were saying that the local currency, Naira as it is called, was so strong against foreign currencies, the dollar most specifically. And so to make Nigerian goods accessible to others so that they can export goods, the government was advised to carry out a structural adjustment program. They placed all kinds of conditionalities, which included devaluing the currency, privatizing things that the government had, and a whole series of things. Now, there is a big, serious problem in that. First of all, the major export of Nigeria then and now was oil, and is oil. And it was not valuated at the local currency, but at the dollar. So devaluing the currency to make exports accessible was ill-advised. It didn't make sense. That's number one. Secondly, by devaluing the money, it just skyrocketed inflation so much that things just started having a free fall in the country. Thirdly, the part of the conditionalities was the privatization process. What happened is that the politicians who, in the first place, had access to stealing oil money were the same people who turned around and bought out the federal government. You see the cycle? So the same people who had been stealing from the country turned around and bought out the country and property of a handful of people. You talk about in the U.S., Occupy Wall Street, 9%. Well, in Nigeria, it's 000 who have succeeded in grabbing the, stealing, looting the national treasury and enriching themselves. And unfortunately, if they were able to invest in the country, it wouldn't be so bad. But they're taking it abroad, investing in Europe, in the U.S., in the French Riviera, in Arab countries, in Switzerland, in France, and can't to stop them away. And so the money is siphoned from the country, and Nigeria will go and borrow it and pay interest on the money that belonged to them, you know, in the first place. That is the tragedy of the situation. And in the process, the middle class has virtually shrunken off. So now it's either you are filthy rich or you are in the bottom poor line.
Sounds like that's, Nigeria needs a revolution to rid itself of this corrupt class.
You know, this is why I am really, really hoping, and if you would, I'm praying that this awakening does not die out. And you know, the politicians saw a writing on the wall. That's why they quickly convened and tried to taper it, because if that fever of protest had continued into this week and into the next, we might have had a French-style revolution in our hand in Nigeria, where the ruling elite who steal the money gets their head chopped off.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.